The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Amy Therese is a socialist, a law student, the co-host of the Dead Pundit Society, and a Me Too heretic. She is also the guest on this week's episode of Zero Squared. The second half of this conversation will be made available to our Patreon listeners through the Inside Zero Books podcast. It's September 13th, 2018, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. I want to remind listeners that Zero Books produces two podcasts every week, one for free and one for people who support us on Patreon. We also run a YouTube channel featuring video essays from myself and the Zero Books team, and we have just started a Zero Books reading group. Patrons who support us at $15 a month receive a new Zero Books title every month, along with an invitation to an online discussion group. The first discussion group will be live streamed on Sunday at 11 a.m. Pacific, and I'll leave a link to the live stream in the show notes for this episode. The music you're listening to right now is a disco version of the Eurythmics' 1984 hit, Sex Crime. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Amy Therese and I discuss affirmative consent, unintended consequences, and socialism. Amy Therese is a law student, a socialist, and the co-host of the Dead Pundit Society podcast. And she's also the guest on this week's Zero Books podcast. And that's all I've got for you, Amy, as far as your bio goes. So if you want to add more to it, you're welcome to, and welcome to Zero Squared.
Oh, no, that's perfect. Yeah, I'm not like, I never know what to say with these kind of things.
That's okay. So yeah, you don't have to say anything more about yourself. That's perfectly adequate. You're becoming famous in the podcast scene. You've been making the rounds on Left Podcast, discussing issues of the day, mostly the Me Too movement or moment, I should say. And it seems to me that predictably, you've stirred up some controversy. I guess most recently you were on the Serious Inquiries podcast, and the host took upon himself to critique what you'd said on his podcast, but he recorded that critique like when you weren't in the room and tacked it onto the end of his podcast.
Basically what happened is I initially went on to talk socialism with Thomas, and we sort of had maybe like a 40-ish minute discussion just generally about like socialism and sort of the differences between, say, like a progressive, like left liberal orientation and like and kind of a socialist one. And it seemed like he may have had some kind of scurrilous interactions with like what could have been tankies online, because he was sort of pleasantly surprised to hear sort of my instantiation of socialism, which is like broadly impersonal, like in the nicest possible way.
Socialism is rounding people like him up and sending them to gulag. It's something else than that. So he was pleased, right?
Yeah, no, not at all. And I also just don't even care. Like, it's not about who's good and who's bad, you know? Mm. Like, anyway, long story short, he sort of cited a situation where he'd had, like, what he might have hoped would be a generative criticism for someone else in kind of the skeptic atheist community that he's sort of generally a part of. So I sort of broadly empathized with what he was saying, but then said, like, it's interesting that you should worry about that, because he was saying that, like, sometimes what people don't understand when he's making a particular critique is that his critique is not meant to be like a purity call. It's not meant to be like a deal breaker. It's just meant to be like, hey, like you could probably do this better, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of use that as a launching pad to sort of identify the fact that sometimes, like, sometimes a left critique that people on the left might make towards liberals can be of a similar intent, but it's not necessarily always received very well by liberals, which is, like, hilarious in terms of the way that played out, because it just, like, really proved my point. Like, I hate to be. Long story short, it seems like he has like a very strong and very personal attachment to the Me Too movement, or what he believes it to be, and is incredibly defensive towards almost everything that I kind of raised as a critique, which is fine. Like, I don't need people to agree with me, but he's basically, his understanding of Me Too, in my opinion, was trading on a radically revisionist understanding of feminism and sort of women's history, the history of sexual assault. And I'm not pretending that Me Too is nothing, or that it won't potentially, you know, be looked back upon as like a watershed moment, etc. But I'm just very conscientious of like overselling what it is that it potentially may have done. And also in doing so, we tend, or at least in my opinion, Thomas tends to not take stock of the broad trajectory of these things that had happened, you know, well in advance of October 2017. Wow. And so basically, subsequent to the recording, he recorded an addendum to the podcast where he refuted a series of kind of misinterpretations of some of the points I was making, which, in its own right, like, it's fine. It's his podcast. He can run it the way he wants to. Cool. But the thing is, like, just upon hearing it later, it just felt like a bit of a shitty move, because, like, not only did he not tell me he was going to do that, but he sort of misconstrued my points. And then his arguments against them were actually all factually incorrect, which meant that what his listeners were left with was basically him kind of systematically so-called correcting a bunch of points that I'd made. But he didn't actually do his diligence, and he wasn't correct.
Right. Can you give me one example of the argument you made, the argument that he thought you'd made, and the facts that he got wrong?
I was saying that, for example, the affirmative consent model that he was advocating is not an a priori good. It has costs and benefits as a model, and there are significant limitations to it conceptually, and this has been demonstrated in Canada, which has been an affirmative consent jurisdiction for the last almost 10 years. And what happened in Canada was a particular case, the JA case, wherein there was a couple who had knowingly and willingly entered into a sexual engagement. They were involved with erotic asphyxiation. And because erotic asphyxiation can at times render you unconscious, that means that the party is no longer under an affirmative consent model. The party is no longer technically capable of consenting to the act, even if they've given consent in advance, because in order for affirmative consent to be meaningful, capacity needs to be maintained by the participants throughout. So that case went up to the Canadian Supreme Court, and it was in fact criminalized, despite the fact that both parties had willingly engaged in the sexual activity. And just the point that I was making is that whatever type of model we use for consent, we need to sort of think really deeply about whether it's serving the function that we want it to serve, i.e. mapping onto the ways sexual dynamics play out in the world. And so, to my mind, when you are criminalizing consensual activity between adults, then that concept isn't doing what we might have hoped it to do.
One question that pops in my mind, and I know I'm going to let you get to how he misrepresented you in just a second, but I just want to interject. When I hear a story like that, is I have to wonder how that case ever got put before the court. Without someone feeling wronged, there would be no way for that. I mean, if you have an agreement like that and nothing goes wrong, then you're not going to be in front of the court. I guess you know what I sound like? I sound like someone's like, why are you concerned about surveillance? If you do nothing wrong, it won't matter, but it does.
To hide, to
right. Exactly. So I don't mean it that way. I just mean to say, like, it seems to me like the question that just immediately pops into my mind is, why was that ever before the court?
To be honest, I read a summary judgment and I have no idea how it ended in the court. I didn't sufficiently read the priors. So I am sort of being hoisted on my own petard in terms of due diligence. But ultimately, I don't think that's really like material in terms of.
No, that's the, not the.
Yeah,
that's
yeah,
not
yeah the, totally. No, but out of curiosity, yeah, I'd totally be curious too. But the way I see these things is ultimately like it doesn't really matter. How it is that it happens to be, in one particular case, how exactly it made its way into a courtroom. The point is, like, if our law is criminalizing acts that consenting adults have otherwise willingly participated in, then as someone who looks critically at the law and the role it plays in shaping our lives and potentially criminalizing activities and people, then I think that concept needs to be looked at with some really close scrutiny.
The answer to you could be just, yes, that's true, and we are willing to criminalize erotic asphyxiation.
Okay, but here's the thing. Like, the problem is people don't then make that leap and bite the bullet. And when I say people, I should probably be more precise. The problem was that Thomas insisted both that this was irrelevant during our conversation, and I don't think it's irrelevant, because what often happens with sexual governance is that it is people on the periphery of society who are most significantly harmed when these concepts don't do what we need for them to do. Like, it is not your middle class heteronormative couple that is gonna be impacted in significant ways when the law doesn't do what we need it to do. It's usually people who are already at the margins. And the other thing is that when we're criminalizing certain types of erotic behavior, we're necessarily relegating that behavior to the realm of the anarchic. Like, we are necessarily making it so that people who want to engage with that will have to engage with it with other people who are perfectly willing to break the law. And as someone who wants to reduce harm, insisting that consensual adults find people who are prepared to behave in a way that is criminal to pursue consensual sexual activity, that's a problem in like a liberal democratic society. And it usually hits people on the fringes of society far more than those who are more normative.
When he repeated your argument, what did he say that you said?
Well, he actually said that, in fact, nothing had been prosecuted on that front in decades, according to an article that he read on Vice. So he has no idea why I brought that up.
Right. But you have a very recent case.
I'd explicitly said within our live interview that there was a Canadian Supreme Court case, and Canada is an affirmative, an affirmative consent jurisdiction, and, this and that. Like,
Right.
And that and a couple of other things. There was something that I'd said towards the end of it. He'd sort of... I don't even mind antagonism, to be honest. Like, I'm a debate nerd. I don't mind people sort of being fiery with me. That's cool. But he'd sort of, his immediate reaction to something I was saying was to accuse me of like MRA apologetics. Yeah. And like in my intuitive, like kind of, I was exhausted at this point. We'd been chatting for a couple of hours, but I sort of revealed like probably like a personal anecdote in order to just sort of rebuff that. And like, the next day I sort of messaged him. I was like, hey, can you cut out like that little bit at the end? Just cause I don't think it's necessary and I don't want to like be overly kind of emotive or rely on kind of personal anecdotes to make a point. Right.
Right. Right.
And he said, yeah, absolutely. Like no problem. And ultimately the podcast was released, I think, like a full week later. So there was no concern in terms of timing, et cetera. But anyway, when I listened to the recording, it was still there, which was just like, it's not that hard to remember that. Like, it's not like I sent him five messages with little requests. Like it was just one.
Right. Yeah. I make a podcast a week and I can imagine myself fucking up and not remembering at the last moment to take that out, especially if I'm rushing or something because I.
Sure. And we're all human.
Right. But he should like, just apologize to you for that is what he should do. And maybe take it down as it is, change it and put up a new version.
Well, no, actually, when he offered to take it down, this is maybe 4 or 5 days after it had been released. He offered to take it down and I actually said, no, like it is what it is now. I think you need to just basically own it. Like it's not a big deal. It's not like I'm not that worried about it. And to be honest, like just it is what it is. But anyway, ultimately this week, he put out a whole other recording, with like a bunch of callers calling in
to complain about you. Basically.
Some were complaints, some were sort of convinced that, you know, some were just condescending as all shit. Like, they're like, you know, Amy seems very confident, but I just really hope she stays on the left because I just feel like, you know, in 10 years, she'll probably be like a classical liberal or a men's rights apologist.
Ugh.
All this shit. Like, first off, can I just say, like, I, for the longest time, have had this like completely unjustifiable, but like pretty bulletproof idea that like performative online like male allies have always just been these like ridiculous red flag to me. Like I want like my male friends and like potential partners or whatever to be like gender egalitarians, obviously. But like to my mind in fucking 2018, I don't need for them to be constantly like touting their bona fides on that front. Like,
yeah,
it's kind of a given. And I feel like you're sort of giving yourself away if you're needing to kind of talk about
this. Well, I don't know. I mean, okay, here's what I'll say. Like one thing, when I heard that he did this, like my first thought was, yeah, he's scared. That was like, you know, you probably came on, said things that made him worried about taking a lot of heat.
No. See, the thing is, he was actually really bombastic and antagonistic.
Okay.
So I would totally get that. And I would appreciate like the concern that like potentially like maybe what I was saying was quite provocative. And I get that. Like Heidi, you've had Heidi Matthews on previously.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
She and I have had to like settle and become accustomed to the fact that like, we don't have many kind of comfortable ideological allies on this one. There's no neat slot of academics that kind of already share where we're at. So we're sort of like pissing off everybody.
Right. So, yes.
Yeah.
It's like when Heidi came on my podcast, when Heidi came on, I was like, I was with her, but then she's like this dirty, you know, postmodernist who aligns. So it's like, I agree with you, but I'm, you know, this curmudgeonly Cartesian Marxist type. But anyhow, so yeah, I understand. It's like finding allies. Do you hear my chickens? by the way.
Yeah, I just have to ask. That's brilliant.
Yeah, it's brilliant. I'm in Portland, so it's not that unusual. It's actually like almost the law for like a couple of minutes in 2009. If you entered the state, they gave you a chicken.
In your Prius?
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, so.
With a bird on it.
Yeah, exactly. So, but now I don't know what the heck they're. I want to go out there. The funny thing is, if I went out there and shouted at them to be quiet, they would be stunned into silence for about 10 minutes. But they're not.
That sounds cruel. No. Not.
Yeah, no. But I know it sounds like this guy was kind of a dick, but I just wonder.
Bitch and dick. Like the recording this week and the way he engaged with both Heidi and myself was just really immature. And he just totally made it about his feelings instead of just being like, oh, I fucked up. I'm sorry. Like, which is so straightforward. Like,
I think that some of this, though, is coming from a commitment to a way of thinking where problems, like, for instance, the problem of sexual harassment or sexual assault, have solutions ready-made, and the only difficulty is
technocratic.
Yeah, the only difficulty is implementing those solutions, and you know, and getting rid of the bad people who are standing in the way.
Absolutely, but I think there's something really interesting there, in as much as I could tell during the conversation. I think to a large extent, he was sort of a little bit discombobulated, just even with the idea of critique as critique. Like, it was almost like I was supposed to have a set of action items, as to like a policy prescription as to like why or what I was saying that differed from what he was saying. So I would sort of raise these points that were at least like dissonant from what he was saying. But then he would just sort of be like, well, I mean, I broadly agree with you, but like, I still don't see like sort of what you're proposing that's different. And it's like, I'm not proposing, like, this isn't.
Yeah, right. Like, I'm just pointing out a problem.
Platform. Like, this is what critique is. Like, and it just, I think that might have been quite alien to him. And it only sort of occurred to me afterwards that like, perhaps that's just not a thing that like, is as common outside of a leftist/academic milieu. I don't know.
I'm reminded of something I saw on Twitter right before we connected here, and I called you or you called me, whatever. There was an exchange between Heidi Matthews and someone who was organizing a conference. I don't know if it was it was probably an academic.
Oh,
conference.
No, not this one. Oh no, yeah. That was terrible.
All I saw was a little bit of it. I saw her asking, why is it that the conference needs to enact rules beyond the rules that are already in place in society around sexual harassment and assault? Why do we need to?
Because rape apologists like you, Heidi. That's
right. And that was her question, right? And there's got to be an answer to that. And the answer is probably something like, well, in order to protect ourselves from lawsuits, and also in order to create a climate that, I think that the real answer would be, we're not concerned with the letter of the law. We're concerned about creating a climate for our conference, which goes beyond that. We want to let people know we will be more punitive than the law will be when it comes to social mores in this conference.
If I could, just for the sake of like totally steelmanning the perspective, and I don't necessarily agree with it, but to my mind, if you want to potentially respond with censure of any kind to participants at the conference, you do want to have some sense of pre-accountability in terms of articulating clearly and explicitly like what the ground rules are, and then that way, should they be broken, whatever response you make, such as, for example, disinviting that particular participant or whatever, like, you sort of ticked all the boxes of kind of legitimacy by stating those in advance.
The question is, what's implied in her question is, why do you need to have the power of censure over your participants rather than the state having that.
Yeah, or even just what's the objective here? What's the differentiate? Like, why do we as adults need extra governance here?
Right. And the answer is complicated, right? I mean, there's, you know, we want to protect ourselves from potential lawsuits. We also want to create a climate that is, you know, welcoming to women or people who feel at risk from sexual harassment, more at risk than, say, white men do. So we want an extra standard of behavior in place. And they're like, once you state that, then I think someone like Heidi, who's sort of a libertarian, not in a right wing way, but a libertarian in a socialist way, but a libertarian socialist type would say, well, let's consider what we're losing when we try to put, you know, these strictures into the space.
Which is the dirty little secret of all of this, that like nobody even wants to think about that question, let alone acknowledge that there could potentially be an answer and there could potentially be costs, right? And I think that's why she and I have been grinding so many gears.
Right. I mean, but I mean, it's, look, if you're interested in, if you're coming from a perspective of saying, hey, I'm against this society of control, like this Foucault notion of the society control.
Maybe not. Like, right. But like to my mind, like if you want to institute extra rules and governance, they're not a priori justified. You need to justify them.
I agree. I totally agree. And there has been a reluctance on the left to justify those kinds of moves. And I think it's because the feeling is that that people are just under attack, that you know, we have to do whatever we can do to protect ourselves. I think for a long time, in the realm of, like, where I've seen this happen the most is in the realm of science fiction, like science fiction conventions and things.
Right, because I know you're a science fiction writer.
Right, yeah. So I think women in the realm of science fiction were, especially, let's say, in the 80s and 90s, were coming into a field that had been dominated by a certain libertine masculine ethic where,
yeah,
like,
boys club.
Yeah, boys club.
Yeah.
Not less so than it had been, but I mean, which was sort of a problem because there used to be such a boys club that sex was just off the table unless you were like gay,
gotcha.
I guess. But now women were showing up and the guys were a little cooler, actually, who were part of the scene, guys like Harlan Ellison or whoever. And, you know, drugs were part of it for a while. And you know, it was there was a bit of debauchery. And so, but in the 90s and after, like, women were coming in not to be fans of these male writers, but with their own career ambitions, very serious ones, and very good writers. I know, right? They were having to navigate this shitty kind of scene. And so there was a, you know, a move to like, hey, I'm not here to play grab ass. Let's put some rules in place. I'm here to, like, you know, win an award. Thank you very much. And that was the mentality behind moving to institute rules and to be very concerned about sexual harassment, in these conventions.
Sure. I mean, to my mind, like, the kind of reflexive turn to rules as method to kind of change or shape cultures and behaviors, again, that's a particular, like, discursive or kind of just action move that people make. And I think it rests, again, on, to my mind, like, premises that are contestable. Like, the idea that we've put in a sexual assault policy is in no way necessarily correlated with the prevalence of behavior that corresponds with sexual assault, right? Like,
right.
Just having a set of rules, like the idea that necessarily reduces certain behaviors is, to my mind, like, questionable.
Right. It is questionable. And also the other thing that happens is that these rules, I feel like I'm off the reservation already, so I don't care what the repercussions are going to be. But these rules are then used for other reasons than just to protect. So, you know,
to power.
Yeah, absolutely. So like there was a guy who showed up and gave a sort of boilerplate MRA kind of style anti-PC speech on a panel.
Sounds really edgy.
Yeah, he was super edgy. And people accused him of being the kind of guy, not of doing it, but being the kind of guy who would harass women. That was like one of the accusations. Well, someone got a vibe from him.
What the fuck is a vibe? If I could, there's an Australian movie. It's called The Castle. And I don't know if you have many Aussie listeners, but basically, like, the central character, like, it's basically this really stereotypical Australian family is about to have their house commandeered by the government who needs to build, like, a flight path.
Mm-hmm.
So they want to object to this. Like, they love their house. They think of it as their castle. Anyway, they get this completely, like, bumpkin, suburban, like, family lawyer. But he's there in the high court, like, arguing about the constitution, and he's completely ill-equipped, and he starts just rambling, and then ultimately, like, one of the key lines that everyone remembers is as he's bumbling and forgetting, like, whatever constitutional component it was that he's supposed to be citing, he just winds up going, you know, it's like the thing, the Australian home, it's like the vibe.
All right, give me one moment, and I will. It's the Constitution of Australia. This is a blatant violation of the Constitution of the Commonwealth of Australia. And when it comes to violations, they don't come any bigger.
What section of the Constitution has been breached?
Section? What section? There is no one section. It's just the vibe of the thing.
I'm afraid, Mr. DeNuto, you'll have to be more specific.
Oh, yeah, sure. Sure. No, I was just starting general, and then I was getting more specific with it. Just one moment, please. Jesus, Daryl, I am sweating here.
Well, see, this is the thing. A lot of what's going on online these days, the way arguments kind of get shaped is they get shaped by vibes.
The vibe.
Yeah. So you, for instance, someone says, that we need to consider how sex is distributed in society. How,
and then I say, what does that even mean?
Right, right. But a lot of other people would say, well, that has a rapey vibe, you know?
Yeah, I'm really bored with that.
Well, I'm with you. But why do you think there is such a turn towards, like, embracing this notion of a vibe? I mean, I think everyone sort of does it without saying it. You know, the other way to put it is, like, well, you know, the thing about you defending MRAs is based on you having a vibe, right? Because certain kinds of arguments are associated with
it. Well, it wasn't even the vibe. It was just the idea that I was stating a particular fact. And sure, because that fact had been weaponized in certain MRA apologetics. What is it? That now that fact is, like, heretofore, like... we don't deal with that actual fact anymore because it might be misappropriate.
Yeah,
like,
there are
people's arguments. Like, what?
Yeah, because that's the facts that the other tribe uses. We have our own alternative facts, I guess. God.
But see, he didn't even object to the fact. It was just a mere idea that I was citing it. It seemed to, again, like, just trigger something in him. It's just like, put your big boy pants on. Like, I'm not, like, if you can't delineate between the arguments I'm making and those of an MRA, well, then it's your comprehension skills that need help.
Right, exactly.
And that sounds really, like, brash and rude. And if I was speaking of an interlocutor with whom, you know, I anticipated future conversations, I would probably be a little more diplomatic.
Like, it's all right. Point,
like, whatever.
Listen, if you told me that I need to put my big boy pants on and step up to have a real conversation, I would just laugh. That's hilarious.
Exactly. That's what I mean. Like, I think also maybe I'm trading on a particular, like real, like who I am in real life, which is like, I'm 5 foot tall. So it's like, I can often be kind of bombastic in like the arguments or discussions I'm making, but because I'm so physically like not intimidating at all, I think that generally like in real life that will tend to work in my favor. But I guess like, you know, in a podcast context, like I'm totally disembodied. So if I'm just being like, I don't know, a bit belligerent or whatever, that sort of.
I listen to the Dead Pundit Society these days, partially just to hear you like, you know, keep Adam Proctor in line and like boss him around.
Bad bossy. Yeah, I was a little bit mean to him in the most recent one.
But well, you know, good. So back to this vibe thing though, I feel like we on the left, and I really include myself here, and this is that have difficulty with difficulties, that we're very quick to want easy answers these days. And it's because I think we feel so impotent and ill-equipped to overcome certain kinds of problems.
It's interesting you should say that, because that was like my sort of background assumption for a really long time. Mm-hmm. But I'm not so sure that that's the only thing going on. I actually think that quite a lot lately, like, I've seen like, well, there's two things. And I guess one of them is really difficult to have a public facing conversation about, because it's generally something that can't be argued for with publicly accessible reasons. But like, I've just been noticing like a shitload of just like kind of pathology. And like, when you try to assess that through a political lens, it leaves you kind of discombobulated. But then finally, like a lot of times lately, when I'm really confused by the particular behavior of somebody and I'm trying to assess it through a political lens, and then suddenly it just dawns on me that they're like a total narcissist, and then it all makes sense. But like, I'm not sufficiently familiar with like psychoanalysis, and even if I were, that's still not like a substantive thing that I can declare about another person, certainly not in like a public argument.
Right.
But like, I don't know, I just feel like there's a bit of that. But then I also think there's a lot of sort of tribalism, and like kind of the incentive structures tend to work to reward people for certain kind of less than nuanced orientations. Yeah. Towards things, you know?
That's for goddamn sure. You know, there's no question about that, especially just in the media in general, and not just on social media, but just if you can create something that is instantly recognizable and has a kind of an emotional impact, and
make America great again.
Exactly. Then you don't have to be right. It doesn't matter if you're right or not. It just means, as long as you connect and you get people to
feel that affective appeal.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just called rhetoric. But the left, especially the radical left, are supposed to be at a point where we're not operating on that level. But the problem is, like what I've noticed as someone who's sort of making a living at this now, is that we're at that level to the extent that we're trying to get noticed in the marketplace of ideas, because that's how you reach an audience, you know? So there are all these externalities to the political project that are really shaping the way we do the discourse, I think.
Well, we're also like, I think that's completely right. But I also think added to that is like, we're all very much like a product, especially people sort of my generation. We're very much a product of a particular like neoliberal hellscape world. And unless you very consciously and repeatedly try to step outside of individuated framing, that's now such a default for almost everything that even if you're not intentionally being, quote, selfish, it's just that the governing logic of our time is one of individualism. So it's kind of, that's kind of the default now. So you have to be making like an active effort to kind of counterbalance that as opposed to like, you know, in historical periods, like you would actually have to be like actively kind of deviating from the norm to be particularly individualist in the way you look at everything.
You know, I'm part of Generation X. I'm like right in the thick of Generation X. Which means I'm an old guy now, which, but I think that my gen, well, I'm middle aged, but the 40, but I think people born after 1970, which I am one of those people, are born into neoliberalism. But how far into neoliberalism they are makes a difference into how they think. So like I still, even though I wasn't around for the 60s, I remember the 60s.
There was still an echo of that kind of in your childhood. Yeah.
Right. And by the time, if you're born in the 80s or in the 90s, you know, you really don't have any connection to that moment where there was a legitimate kind of feeling that lasted for a while that there was going to be a massive social change. I think the last time there was anything like it was not so long ago. It was 2011, but it was a blip instead of a long lasting movement that with Occupy Wall Street and the Arab Spring but anyway, I think you're right that we're not situated well historically to deal with the problems that we're dealing with because we've been shaped by what's happened to our world and to our, you know, culture and then also to the government and to the economy, all of it. But on the other hand, you know, we've got all these tools and we can communicate faster and better than ever, and we can develop ideas in ways like I can do a podcast on Marx and have 4,000 listeners. You know, it's not only about Marx, but Marx is in there all the time. And there was no mainstream or even small scale, like small radio station Marxist program in the 90s or 80s that anyone was listening to. So
no, yeah, like the bounds of possibility that have been opened by the internet, broadly speaking, and certainly podcasts being one particular instantiation of that. Like it's a complete and utter paradigm shift, and there's no other way to describe it. Like, and I guess there are contradictions inherent in anything like that. Obviously, I don't know whether this is necessarily even political, but you know, I can't speak for other people, but I know, like, I've found certainly something about podcasting as a medium is particularly intimate in as much as it sort of beams into your ears. And it's generally the type of media that you consume, like, just by yourself as opposed to with other people. And so I think there's, very much like, there's something meaningful, I think, in the dynamic between podcasters and audience members, because you're sort of able to speak to people in moments where perhaps like the conditions around them are not providing that that sense of like connection or solidarity. And I think that can be really meaningful. Like I had moments where, you know, someone like Felix on Chopper would say something sort of vaguely similar to what I'm talking about now. And like, you know, when you're just having a fucking lonely moment and the fact that you can have beaming into your ears, like people who sort of think similarly to you and will be saying kind of provocative things that no one around you even understands when you try to chat with them about them. Like, I think that can be really meaningful. But I'm not sure how much that needs to be like an ongoing and overarching element of what you do. I feel like it's almost just like a potential fringe benefit if you happen to like sort of connect with people in what you do, you know?
When I started listening to podcasts, I was at a job I hated and I didn't want to talk to anybody. So I would put in earbuds and listen to podcasts whenever I was on a break. I was in my head. I get emails from people who say, I'm so lonely where I'm at. The only person who keeps me sane is you, Doug. I mean, not a lot of these, but every once in a while I'll get an email kind of like that. And I feel like, in early days when I was a smaller podcast, I would sometimes I would have a listener, want to talk to me. And so we'd have a Skype conversation just to see what's going on. And I remember there was one guy who was just telling me about, he was like 30 years old, still living with his parents, didn't know what to do with himself, didn't like himself. What can I tell him to do as a Marxist?
Go to therapy, bro.
And I was like, oh, go to therapy? I don't know.
If you can, if you have the financial resources.
What I should have told him was, clean your room.
Wash your dick. Stand up straight. Don't you dare do anything political.
That's right. Anyway, so yeah, it is. But it's an expression of alienation. I don't feel that podcasts are capable of overcoming personal, individual moments of alienation. But maybe,
or collective alienation.
I don't know. Maybe we can model a way of thinking.
Well, that's the thing I was going to say is sort of when you sort of floated that as a potential thing to discuss, I was thinking about it and I was like, to me, the way the left can attempt to combat alienation is through politics. And it's a long-term, it's a political goal as opposed to something tangible that we can do in kind of the here and now. To my mind, anything interpersonal we can do in the interim is just kind of a salve for the status quo, right? But dealing with alienation is going to be a result of instantiating the political changes necessary to generate a world where alienation is not the status quo of the majority of people, the majority of days due to living in a capitalist hellscape.